Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Flu season is just beginning, but brace yourself. It's only going to get worse from here until we hit a peak in about a few months from now. Last year, the word on the street was that the flu shot was less effective than usual. So how about this year? And what does the flu forecast portend? How can there even be a flu forecast? We're going to talk about how the season is shaping up this time around and how healthcare workers fight a continuous battle against a host of rapidly mutating influenza viruses. Sound exciting? It is. Joining me now is Christine Finley, Immunization Program Chief for the Vermont Health Department. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Richard Enelow, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. He researches influenza and the body's immune response to it. Dr. Enelow, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
So this is going to sound remedial, but I guess I've never really thought that much about what exactly flu is. I mean, I know it's a virus, but how does that actually infect cells? How does it cause damage? How does it work on your body? Christine Finley, I'll start with you.
So yes, flu is a virus and it's spread by droplet infections. So when someone talks, sneezes, coughs, or the virus may land on surfaces where it can stay alive for 24 hours or so. One of the things we find with the virus is it often infects the respiratory system to start with. We can see some side effects of that you can sometimes get when it's a nasty flu, such as most often one of the things we look for is pneumonia or bronchitis.
What is it? I mean, yeah. How does it actually work on the body?
So one of the different things with flu is the influenza virus tends to come on suddenly, and you'll feel lousy within 24, very quickly. You'll have people say like, oh, I just feel like a truck hit me. Whereas the common cold, that tends to come on slow, and you may start with the sore throat and move to a cough and move to one thing after another. But that the symptoms that you typically get with the flu, remember, are fever, cough, sore throat, headache, body aches, and so really a general feeling of feeling poorly.
Right. So people who say, I've been throwing up all night, I have the flu, that's not probably the same thing?
So if it's just, you can get nausea and vomiting with the flu in some cases, but if it's just tends to be something like that oftentimes may be more GI or food related.
So why does everybody say I have the flu? I have the 24-hour flu. It doesn't really work that way.
No, the flu is not 24 hours usually either. No, the flu is usually a week or longer. The 24 hours of something coming and going is not typically the flu.
Right. You can have a 24-hour bug, but it's probably not flu.
Correct.
Dr. Enelow, flu doesn't really usually start in humans. Is that right? It starts in other species and then can sort of pass to humans?
Well, it has a natural reservoir in wild birds, and it periodically jumps to different species. And so humans are actually sort of an accidental host for the influenza. And every year, whatever jumps from one species, usually birds, to humans, becomes one of the strains or at least the beginning of one of the strains that gets passed around through the human population around the world. And at the end of that flu season, that particular strain is usually not seen again, at least not the exact strain. So in many respects, we're sort of a dead-end accidental host.
Huh. So the flu virus, if it had a brain, wouldn't choose a human as a host?
No, I don't. Well, to anthropomorphize, it
right.
wouldn't choose anything other than a bird, but flu can actually infect all manner of mammals. It affects horses, it infects, of course, pigs, most famously, but it's been found in seals and tigers and just about every horses. There was a large equine outbreak in the 1890s. But whenever it does jump species, it tends to undergo changes, and those are the changes that are obviously random but can result accidentally in something that can become much more virulent in that species.
So how do scientists and researchers predict or have an understanding of which strains are going to be most active in any given year?
Well, that's something that is generally predicted in the spring based on what is circulating in other parts of the world. And there's a window of opportunity because the manufacturing of the vaccine takes some time. So the CDC and the WHO, World Health Organization, do a lot of monitoring around the world. And in spring, they make a decision to go with certain strains that look like they're likely to be the primary strains we're going to be dealing with. And they're usually either right or close. And then the massive, mobilization of all number of different types of manufacturing and whatnot occurs such that we have as many doses as we do, which is quite a few, by the fall.
So people should already be getting their flu vaccine, and I know that this is something the health department really puts the full court press on, that you should be getting the vaccine. And Christine Finley, can you describe why that's helpful if in cases like last year you kept hearing it's 40% effective, which doesn't sound very high? I mean, I guess if you phrase it another way and say it gives you a 40% better chance of not getting the flu or not getting a severe case of it, that sounds better. But so why is the flu vaccine so important?
So the flu vaccine is important for a number of reasons. I'll hit the top four. And the first one is it does decrease your risk of getting flu. And you're right. Last year overall was 40% effective. It was about 53% effective in kids, younger kids. So that's important in those 6 months to 4 years. And it was less effective than 40%, I think closer to 23% with the older adults because of changes in the immune system all. But one of the things is if you think about it, if it reduces your risk of getting the flu, and we know with flu can come complications. A lot of times you might be fine, but particularly those with chronic disease have complications. I'll take a 40% decreased chance of getting it. The second thing is it decreases the severity and the symptoms for those that do get sick with the flu. And that's a very important one.
How does that work? If it's, I mean, you think of a vaccine as preventing an illness. So how does it work to reduce the severity of an illness if you've gotten it, even though you've gotten the vaccine?
Right. So you may have gotten the flu, but the way that it impacts the virus, it may have hit some of it, but not enough to keep you from getting the flu. So you've got some partial response. And so you got the flu, but studies that have shown getting the flu vaccine reduces the risk of getting admitted to the hospital by 33% if you do get the flu. And they also looked at, there's a new CDC study that said when you're hospitalized with the flu, patients who didn't have the flu vaccines that year were 2 to 5 times more likely to be in the hospital than to be ill. The third thing is that it limits transmission to others, and that's really important. When you think about limiting transmission to those that are at higher risk, the older, pregnant women, young children, and by limiting transmission, you limit the spread and the overall amount of flu. And the last thing is it minimizes the impact of inflammation. And an often under-recognized danger of flu is that you get this resulting inflammatory reaction that can last several weeks after a flu. And that can worsen certain chronic health conditions, including and may lead to a heart attack or a stroke. And that's where a lot of the research is actually looking at now and trying to emphasize and raise awareness so that those with chronic conditions do get vaccinated.
So if you get flu and you have diabetes or you have heart disease, then even when you feel like you're better from the flu, you're still at risk of having a complication with your chronic disease?
And that's exactly what they're finding. You got it. They looked and found that the risk of heart attack for laboratory-confirmed flu, so not just, I guess I had flu, but someone who truly has been shown to have flu, is increased in that week after you've had the flu.
Is that just because your immune system is battered or why?
No, what they found is that there's an inflammatory response. And so that inflammatory response may impact the heart and may impact it, basically messes with the homeostasis of the body.
Dr. Enelow, do we have a sense of what the forecast is for this year? I mean, I remember last year people were predicting a really bad flu season, and it was. So what are we thinking for this year?
Well, that's always hard to say, and Christine might be better able to answer this. But Last year, the prevailing strain was an H3N2, which is one of the four strains that were floating around. And that one was particularly difficult from the standpoint of drifting away from being neutralized by the vaccine as well as being slightly more virulent. Now, the likelihood is thus far that I think that the cases that have been reported so far are the H1N1, which is the strain that popped up in 2009 as a pandemic strain and now has replaced the other H1N1. And it's a bit less virulent, more readily neutralized by the antibody. But that's just a prediction. And the CDC monitors this on a week-by-week basis.
So, Christine Finley, what about that? What are you hearing?
So a couple things. One of the things, realized that when we were enjoying our beautiful summer, the Southern Hemisphere was having winter. And so Australia tended to have a milder season than they've had in the past few seasons, and H1N1 or the A viruses were the predominant viruses that circulated. So far this year, we've got five states that have reported local spread, and the rest have pretty much said sporadic spread. The only one near our area with local was Massachusetts. The one thing I'll say is that if you look at the last 35 years, the peak of the flu season is typically late January into February and the beginning of March. And so even though we say we never know when it's going to come and get prepared or whatever, we do tend to know that it may be in late January. It starts usually in December, and we do know that that flu is circulating and tends to circulate all year long.
We got a note from Terry and Brandon on that topic who says, I was told that it's best to wait until after Thanksgiving to get a flu shot because this allows the vaccine to be effective further into the flu season. Is there any truth to this?
After Thanksgiving is a little later than what I've heard, but yes, there is truth to that. We know that the flu vaccine wanes, and depending on which report you read, you might think it wanes anywhere from between 5% and 20% per month. And so if you're waiting till October, November to get a flu vaccine, that's a fine time. We have seen it popping up around the country where they're encouraging it in August and early September. And particularly for people that are older that may not mount as good an immune response, their vaccine could really have waned by the time they really need that protection.
You mentioned that we're looking at places like Australia to get an idea of what our flu season might look like because their flu season is, you know, wintertime. But can you explain the global spread of flu? Because you'd think, I mean, how is it being spread and how is it getting from one place to the next? And why is it so seasonal? If Australia has a really bad flu season and a lot of people are traveling back and forth, why don't we get a really bad flu season in August because of transmission from actual, you know, active cases there? Or, you know, how does it work to sort of go around the world?
I'll start, and my partner might. I think that part of it is we see flu circulate in the winter months, and particularly in the temperate climates, that's when we know it's going to circulate. So and we do have the global transmission where there may be, it may be a chance to transmit it. But when you look at what happens in the winter, there's a lot of things that contribute to it.
Yeah. So tell us more, Dr. Enelow.
Well, that's been a subject of debate for a long time, but the theories include the fact that people are inside more and closed up more and more and therefore exposed to each other more. But there's another aspect that has to do with the fact that the air is drier. And when you sneeze, for example, or cough, you're basically emitting a spray of droplets that contain influenza particles in mucus and such. And the speed with which the mucus evaporates, so if it's humid out, a little particle of mucus is going to land right on the ground. Whereas if it dries out very quickly, the viruses can actually float around in the air for an extended period of time. So that's one of the theories. It's not otherwise entirely clear, and it's not otherwise always the case that flu is only seen in the wintertime. The mother of all flu pandemics in 1918 started initially in January and went all through the spring, summer, and fall. And it was in October, really, that it did its greatest damage, but it went all summer long.
As far as viruses go, how contagious is flu?
It's extremely contagious. It's the average, respiratory virus, a cold virus, and whatnot, is contagious basically from the standpoint of when you get it on your hands. So hand washing is the primary way of preventing the spread of colds. Influenza can spread by airborne means, which is unusual. But on the other hand, the degree to which it transmits is significantly higher, for example, than if anybody remembers the SARS outbreak. So it's about 100 times more transmissible than SARS. And the public health measures which contained the SARS outbreak, which was basically isolation and whatnot, worked largely because it wasn't as transmissible as a virus like the flu. It probably would not have worked the same way if that was as transmissible as influenza.
Yes, I was in Southeast Asia for the SARS virus, and every border crossing you had to have your temperature taken. You could get quarantined if you were suspected to have SARS. So yes, I certainly remember that. We're talking about the flu today, what to expect this year, how to protect yourself, and how medical researchers try to stay one step ahead of all the marauding viruses we encounter each fall. And let's go to Mitch, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Mitch. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So here's my question. I went to get a flu shot, and my pharmacist, and I also went to ask about a shingles vaccine. And my pharmacist said I had to wait 4 weeks in between those two shots for them to really be effective. But I looked on the CDC website, and it said you could get the shots the same day in different arms. So do I have to wait 4 weeks? Who's right?
Christine Finley, what do you think?
You can get the shots the same day.
Okay, so there's no waiting period.
There's no waiting period. What I thought you were going to mention is that there is a shortage of the Shingrix vaccine nationally, and so that they might have wanted you to wait because they were out of it.
All right. So when we're talking about vaccines and how they work and how they interact, we were talking a little bit about about what we're expecting this season. But do we have a sense yet of how effective this year's flu vaccine is compared to last year, Christine Finley?
We do not. And we typically get the preliminary information the third week in February.
Okay. So, we were talking also earlier about how the flu works and how the flu works in the body. But Dr. Anilow, can you talk a little bit about how the body responds to flu to try to fight it? And I mean, is it your immune response that kills you for people who are dying from the flu, or is it the flu itself? I mean, what actually happens?
Well, that's a good question. It's variable. For people who, for example, who have not had a vaccine, the virus infects the lining of the nasal and then subsequently the lower respiratory tract, generally the airways. And there's two arms of the immune system that operate to keep it under control. The first is the innate immune system, which is the early response, which is associated with the fever, and generally the more robust the innate immune response, the sicker, quote unquote, you might feel. The innate response keeps the replication of the virus under control while in the few days that it takes the what's called the adaptive immune response, which is the cellular immune response. And that's a response that comes in, the cells make their way into the lung, and they actually sniff around for infected lung cells and essentially kill them. And the idea, if there was an idea, The advantage is that the cells which are virus factories, so to speak, are killed prior to their ability to spew out many more particles to spread to other cells. So the response to the virus is basically to destroy some of your lung cells, and the balance between how many of your lung cells are infected and how many are killed by your own immune system has a lot to do with how the clinical outcome is. But for the most part, if the virus doesn't replicate overly quickly and the immune system responds in a reasonable time frame, then the amount of damage to the lung is limited. At the same time, in the very young and the very old, it does set the stage for secondary bacterial infection, and particularly in the older folks, that is the primary cause of death in most years of influenza and epidemics. Now, in the years associated with pandemics, and a pandemic is when a brand new strain hits the world's population, such as in 1918, 1957, 1968. Where no one has ever had anything like it and has no immunity, the ability to evade the host responses long enough to replicate to high levels prior to the adaptive response coming in may lead to a mismatch such that many lung cells are infected by the time the adaptive response comes around, and you can essentially wipe out your own lungs. And that's a slightly different type of flu-related death, which fortunately we see relatively infrequently in inter-pandemic years. But for the most part, most of the damage and most of the suffering that comes from influenza comes largely as a result of your own immune system.
We're talking about flu today, and lots of people who have questions for us. Peter is calling in from Johnson. Hi, Peter. What are you wondering about?
So I have had colds fairly frequently, and the first year I got a flu shot, I discovered that I actually got colds less frequently. Is there any sort of co-immunity that comes along with that, or any sort of activation of the immune system that helps with that process?
Interesting question, Peter. What do you know, Dr. Enelow?
Not that we know of. I think that the likelihood of any individual sort of association either with, and we see this a lot, getting sick, within a certain time frame after getting the vaccine or not getting sick, is probably a matter of random chance. And it's hard to draw conclusions from observations like that, but plenty of people do, particularly when people say that I'm not getting the flu shot because it always gives me the flu. And that's one of the things we oftentimes have to explain, especially because when you have a good immune response to a flu shot, you can oftentimes feel a little crummy, which should be recognized as a good sign. You're making an immune response.
Well, while we're talking about vaccines, let's go to Leslie in St. Albans. Hi, Leslie. Go right ahead. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding the thimerosal in the vaccines. They told me that the preservative-free option had only trace amounts, or I don't know if it was none at all, but I wondered if your guest could clarify that for me.
Leslie, thanks for the call. So Christine Finley, can you talk about preservatives in vaccines and what Leslie's questioning here?
Yes, thank you for asking. Thimerosal is only available in the multi-dose flu vaccine, which is the and it's a very small amount. So it's one of the fewer vaccines that we see used. Again, there's been nothing to show that thimerosal creates adverse effects.
What is thimerosal?
Thimerosal is a component of mercury, but not the bad mercury. And it was taken out of the vaccines in an abundance of caution many years ago, never been shown to cause harm. But most of the flu, it's in very few vaccines. For the vaccines that we provide for children through the health department, we don't provide any vaccines with thimerosal because it's only in the multi-dose and it's used probably less than 20% of all vaccines now.
And somebody who wants to get a flu shot can specify which type they want?
Yes, they usually can.
And what about the nasal spray? I mean, this is another option, right? But it's a slightly different thing.
So the nasal spray was not on the market for the previous two flu seasons because it was found to be ineffective against the H1N1 virus. They've redone the nasal spray, and it was approved for use this year. And the CDC did not create a preference with it. We still haven't seen how effective it is, but it is there, and it's for children from age 2 years to adults 49 years of age, but pregnant women may not receive it.
So let's say, for example, asking for a friend, you have children who don't like to get shots. Is the nasal spray a good option for them?
In Vermont, the nasal spray is not going to be very widely available for children, and that part of that is that we had ordered all the flu vaccine before they made the approval, and we couldn't change it. But also, the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that since we haven't seen how it works and out of concern that they recommend it only for children that are really needle phobic.
Leslie, we talked to. Let's talk to James in Randolph. Hi, James.
Hello. I was calling in the context of a comment that your guest made earlier with respect to interspecies transfer. He had specifically mentioned an equine transfer, bovine, porcine, and even gave an example of a feline transfer in the context of a tiger. What about canines? How come we never hear about that?
Dr. Enelow?
That's a good question. Of all the cases and reports I've seen, I have not seen any that indicate that canines have gotten it or can get it. But that may just be by chance, but it's very hard to say. The species that are most likely to get it are those which come in contact with other types of species that can get it. And you might say, well, how would a seal come in contact with another type of flu-carrying species? There was just a recent outbreak of influenza B among seals, and because nobody really knows very much about influenza B or where its animal reservoir lies, but it's presumably a matter of chance, but it may be more than that. We just don't know.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, I don't typically interact with seals, so, you know, you never know. But yeah, to James's question, there are a lot of dog-human interactions, especially around Vermont. We're a dog-loving place. Cindy says, hi, I'm on vacation listening to Vermont Edition, and I'm wondering if the flu strain is the same all over the country, or are there different strains depending on where you live? Christine?
So the CDC will provide information weekly on what we're seeing. And typically, we do see that the flu strains may be similar across the country. A lot of times, we'll see that it starts with A, and towards the end of the season, for whatever reason, we'll see B. We may see some variation also among the ages, something a little different with the young versus the old.
But the flu shot is going to be the same whether I get it in Missouri or California or Vermont?
Yes, it is, and it's going to protect you against what we know to be most likely the viruses that are circulating this year.
Dr. Enelow, could we ever see a universal flu vaccine?
It's possible. It's possible. There are a number of groups working on that. In fact, there was a recent report that just came out about something that was generated in llamas that they refer to as nanobodies because they're very small antibodies, and they managed to get into crevices of the influenza stalk that larger antibodies can't get access to. And it's something that quite a number of people are working on, and that's obviously the holy grail to be able to immunize, much like we immunize for measles or smallpox, which we don't immunize for smallpox anymore, but and simply be able to do it maybe every 5 or 10 years, and also have something available for a new pandemic.
That would be nice. Let's keep our fingers crossed and that more people like the two of you are doing work on this as well. Christine Finley is Immunization Program Chief for the Vermont Department of Health. And Dr. Richard Enelow is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine, who researches influenza and the immune response to it in our body. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.